wasn't in. Yeah, she's an actress. I consulted my memory to see if it could offer any data on an actress called Huggins. It had no suggestions. Well, that's nice. Yeah, so's my dad. Might I know them? Dunno. They both use acting names. She's called Anna Massey, and he calls himself Jeremy Brett. But, good God! Anna Massey, coming to see me in a play. Well, not expressly to see me, but coming to a play that I was in. Your father won't be there as well, will he? No, they're divorced. He's gay. Is he? I didn't... Well, goodness. Blimey. My word. I tottered off, numb with excitement. We had our four or five performances under the fluttering bats. Ariel sprinted about, Caliban squeaked and gibbered, I boomed, Prospero got down the front and had a good old shout. Anna Massey graciously applauded. In the meantime, I'd been helping prepare for the May Ball. It so happens that the patron or visitor of Queen's College is, appropriately enough given the Foundation's name, whoever might happen to be Queen at the time, a position she holds until her death. From the 1930s to the 50s, the Queen was, of course, Elizabeth, wife of George VI. After George died, now styled the Queen Mother, she remained in place. There's a point to all this. We're at a meeting of the May Ball Committee. Much of the time is taken up with the particular details that you might expect. How to run the roulette table without falling foul of the gaming acts. Who will be in charge of escorting the Boomtown rats to the tent set aside as their changing room. Whether or not there will be enough ice in the champagne bar. The usual kind of administrative trivia. The president turns to me. Got your Magdalen and Trinity invitations yet? Yup, and Claire. One of the perks of being on a May Ball committee was that you received free invitations to other May Balls. Aside from our own, I was going to the ball at Clare, one of the prettiest of the colleges, where my cousin Penny was also a fresher, and to the two grandest of all, Trinity and Magdalen. So grand were they that gossip columnists and photographers from the Tatler and Harper's and Queen attended. You could get away with a dinner jacket at Clare and Queen's, but Trinity and Magdalen insisted on white tie and tails. The higher companies did a roaring trade. Only King's, a mixed college and proud of its radical and progressive ethos, refused to hold a May Ball. Their summer party was called instead, with dour literalism, the King's June Event. Good, the president of the committee says to me. Oh, one other little thing. Dr. Walker sent me a note saying that if the Queen Mother dies, the college has to go into mourning for a week, during which no entertainments or celebrations of any kind can be held. Certainly not a May Ball. Perhaps you might look into insurance to cover that. Insurance? I tried to sound casual and unconcerned, as if arranging insurance policies is something I've been doing since I was an infant. Right. Yes, sure. Of course. The meeting ends, and I slip into the public phone box in the corner of Friar's Court and start ringing around insurance companies. Sun Life, can I help you? Ah, yes. I'm calling up about getting a policy.
Life, car, commercial or property?
Well, none of those, really.
Marine, travel or medical?
Well, again, none. It's, to insure against having to cancel an event.
Abandonment?
That's the term, is it? Abandonment? Well, yes, abandonment, then.
Hold, please, caller.
I wait until a tired voice comes on the line.
Special services, how can I help?
I'm ringing about getting a policy to insure an event. I think you call it abandonment?
Oh, yes, what sort of event?
Well, it's a party.
An outdoors event, is it?
Well, it's a ball, mostly on lawns in tents, but some parts are inside.
I see, and you want rain cover. Partial or complete abandonment?
No, not rain cover, so much as rain cover.
Excuse me?
Sorry, no, I mean, well, it's to insure against the Queen Mother dying. The sound of a receiver being banged on the desk, followed by a blowing down the earpiece.
Something wrong with the line. Sounded like... Well, never mind. Could you repeat that, please?
Here in the 21st century, there are probably only two insurance companies left in the world, called Axentander or something equally foul, but in 1979 there were dozens. I tried the Royal, Swan, Prudential, Pearl, Norwich Union, all those I had heard of, and a dozen that I hadn't. In each case, once I had succeeded in getting the agent to understand what was required, I was asked to call back. I imagine that they needed to consult higher up the chain of command. It might be said that they had abandonment issues. This kind of insurance is, of course, nothing more nor less than gambling. You bet your stake, which insurance companies call a premium, and should your horse win, house catch fire, car get stolen, royal family member die, you collect your winnings. The relationship between the premium and the amount collected is determined by balancing the value of the insured thing, the indemnity, against the odds and statistical probability of its being threatened. Bookies use the form and stud books, together with the market flow of betting, to determine their prices. Insurance companies use a similar mixture of market trends and their own history and precedent books, which they call actuarial tables. I can understand that. Had I wanted an abandonment policy against snow and ice, they would have looked at the value of the May Ball and seen that they would have to shell out £40,000 if it was cancelled. They would also see that blizzards in early June are incredibly rare, even in Cambridge, so they would probably charge a fraction of 1% of the indemnity. £20 would be ungenerous, but then only an idiot would bother to insure against so remote a contingency in the first place. With a rain policy, the insurers might decide, after consulting forecasters and local records, that there was, say, a 50-50 chance of precipitation, in which case the premium would be a whopping £20,000. But then, what kind of an idiot would arrange a summer party in England which was so weather-dependent that it would have to be abandoned if the heavens opened? Abandonment policies are not very common, that is the point. But there are nonetheless fairly obvious mechanisms in place for resolving the issue of price when it comes to natural disasters like weather, fire, and earthquake. The death of the monarch's mother, on the other hand, how could an actuary be expected to calculate the odds of that? She was 79 years old. I decided that I would give the companies 3 hours before calling back for a quote. Did the insurance clerks go into her family history and check out the longevity of the entire Bowes Lyon clan? Did they call up Clarence House and inquire into the Queen Mother's health, diet and exercise regime? Did they take into account her reputed fondness for gin and Dubonnet? I can only imagine the discussions they must have had in their offices. In the case of each firm, when I called back, the actuaries appeared to be very gloomy about the old girl's hopes of making it through the next few months. 20, 25, 23% chances of her surviving until the middle of June were implied by the gigantic premiums they proposed. The cheapest offer, 20% of the indemnity, was way beyond our reach. I had been given a budget of £50. I'm afraid, I tell the president of the committee after returning from the last of the calls, that we are simply going to have to pray for Her Majesty's continued good health. If she does die, I will undertake to keep the news from the fellows if I have to steal every newspaper and radio in the college and lock them all in a cellar to do so. I may hold you to that, the president said, a worried look furrowing his youthful brow. I do not suppose that a queen's life has been prayed for more assiduously since the days of Boudicca. Sadly, the Queen Mother did die, though happily for us, not for another 23 years. When she finally left the world in 2002, she was thoughtful enough to do so in March, meaning that the college's period of mourning would be well over by May week. It was just such examples of kindness and consideration that endeared her to so many during a long, varied and vigorous life. Sometime in the 1990s, sitting next to her at a dinner, I considered thanking her on behalf of the college for so thoughtfully delaying her death, but shyness and good sense got the better of me. Another feature of the Cambridge Easter term, for so they call the third term of the academic year, is the Footlights May Week Review. The Footlights Club is one of the university's best-known institutions, having sent generations of comic writers and performers into the world over the course of its 130-year history. Its May Week show at the Arts Theatre was an annual ritual. If you were cool, it was an event to disdain. Apparently the Footlights are crap this year, you would say to your companion as you wrinkled your nose at a poster for the event. There has never been a year in which this has not been said. The same phrase would have been heard when Jonathan Miller was running the footlights, or Peter Cook and David Frost, through Cleese, Chapman and Idle, and past Douglas Adams, Clive Anderson and Griff Rhys-Jones, Dave Baddiel and Rob Newman, David Mitchell and Robert Webb, all the way out to the current year. If you were normal, such cynicism did not occur to you, and the May Week Review was another fun fixture on the Cambridge calendar. I was neither cool nor normal, but simply too busy with the Tempest and other things to be able to attend. I heard that someone was putting together a production of Oedipus Rex for Edinburgh, and decided that I might as well go and audition. I boomed and strutted and gestured and declaimed in front of the director, Peter Rumney, and left thinking that perhaps I'd rather overdone it. The next day I found in my pigeonhole a note from Peter asking me to play Oedipus. I was bound for the festival fringe, and my excitement was almost impossible to contain. For the rest of the term I bounced and buzzed about Cambridge like a bee in a bottle. At some point I believe I must have sat some exams. Prelims, I think they were called. I remember precisely nothing about them, not where they took place, nor what kinds of questions we were given to answer. I suppose I must have passed them, for no trouble arose and no stern interviews were sought. My Cambridge proceeded pleasantly enough without the intrusion of academic study. A university is not, thank heavens, a place for vocational instruction. It has nothing to do with training for a working life and career. It is a place for education, something quite different. A real education takes place not in the lecture hall or library, but in the rooms of friends, with earnest frolic and happy disputation. Wine can be a wiser teacher than ink, and banter is often better than books. That was my theory, at least, and I was living by it. Such serene and lofty views of education as against vocational training were beginning to madden the new political leadership. Thatcher was an industrial chemist and a lawyer, after all, both disciplines that need grad grindery and training and require no education whatsoever, as she demonstrated. Our kind of loose learning, as they would regard it, this cleaving to the elitist tradition of the liberal arts, this arrogant Athenian self-indulgence, was an enemy, a noxious weed that required summary eradication. Its days were numbered. The 1979 Queen's May Ball took place. I donned the tailcoat that I'd rented for the week, all ready to, well, to have myself a ball. We happy, flushed, proud and excited members of the committee met for champagne half an hour before the kick-off. 10 minutes later, I was in an ambulance on my way to Addenbrooke's hospital, an oxygen mask over my face, fighting for every breath. Bloody asthma. It would be another 2 years before I fully understood what had brought it on. I often succumbed to attacks at weddings, fetes, hunt balls, or events of that kind. On such occasions, there were usually flowers and summer pollen about, so it had never occurred to me that the cause of my face going blue and my lungs closing for business was actually champagne. A ridiculous allergy, but one doesn't choose them. At Addenbrooke's, an injection of adrenaline had such an immediately restorative effect that I was out of the hospital in a cab and on the way back to Queen's by 10, two fresh inhalers for emergencies, spoiling the sweep and cut of my dress trousers. I was determined not to miss another minute. May balls traditionally end with a breakfast, and many partygoers like to welcome the dawn on the cam. Even at that young age I was a sentimental and slushy fool, Magdalene, spelled Maudlin, to a dreadful fault. I am none the less so now, and shall never find the sight of young men in dégagé evening wear, punting their loved ones along the river on a summer's morning, anything other than agonisingly romantic, piercingly lovely, and heart-stoppingly adorable. Caledonia 1. After the term ended, I took myself off as usual to North Yorkshire to teach a little Latin, umpire Cundall Manor's second 11, prepare the games field for sports day, and in such spare time as I had, learn the role of Oedipus, as well as lines for my various parts in a production of Charles Marowitz's Arto at Rhodes, which the Cambridge Mummers were presenting, and in which I had also, perhaps foolishly, agreed to appear. Foolishly because each day for a fortnight, the moment the curtain went down on Arto, I was going to have to hair off to the venue where Oedipus would be due to start half an hour later. Old Edinburgh hands said I would be cutting it fine, especially if I had complicated costume to doff and don, or heavy makeup to remove and apply, but cutting it fine was one of the things I liked to do. For 3 weeks in late summer, Edinburgh is the world centre of student drama. I was to perform at the Fringe every year for the next 5 years at least. Most who go cannot fail to fall instantly in love with the city as much as with the event. Within a couple of days, the muscles on your shins ache from the unaccustomed steep ascents and descents of the town. The numberless stone steps and narrow wynds surprise your muscles. If you were used to the easy, level streets of East Anglian towns and a sedentary life, it did more than surprise them. It shocked and outraged them. The ancient, towering grimness of Edinburgh's old tenements, with their stone staircases and minatory blank gabling, made me feel that at any moment Burke and Hare, Deacon Brodie, or Mr. Hyde were about to rise snarling from the steps of the grass market. What did arise were, of course, nothing more terrifying than young drunks bearing polystyrene trays of spud-you-like with cheese. In those days, baked potato takeaways provided the cheapest form of filling nutrition a student could require. Scotland really was another country. The diet was different. Aside from spud-you-like, the chicken carry-out shops offered the delicate spécialité du pays, deep-fried Mars bars, wagon wheels and curly-whirlies. Scottish banknotes were different. The language, the weather, the light, even the Kensitas cigarettes were unfamiliar. A pint of heavy was the preferred drink, heavy being bitter, or at least a gassy something that gestured towards the idea of it. Everywhere about the city, on every wall, window, lamppost or doorway, were posters for plays, comedies and idiosyncratic entertainments that combined everything from circus, music hall, surrealist balloon manipulation and ballet to street percussion, Maoist limbo dancing, gender-bending operetta and chainsaw juggling. Members of the casts of these shows would dress up and run down the streets, showering the good-naturedly reluctant passers-by with leaflets and complimentary tickets. On the opening day, a parade of floats moved slowly east along Prince's Street. There was somewhere in the city, or so we were told, a proper and official festival being held. Professional theatre companies and international orchestras performed plays and concerts for grown-ups in smart concert halls and theatres. But we saw or knew nothing of these. We were the Fringe, a vast fungus-like organism that spread its filaments throughout the fabric of Edinburgh, into the dossiest accommodations, weirdest sheds, huts, warehouses and wharves, and into every church hall and functional space large enough to house a punk magician and a few chairs. Halfway along the Royal Mile, which runs down from Edinburgh Castle to Holyrood Palace, stood the Fringe office, where festival-goers queued up for tickets. There were two shows I knew that I simply had to see. One was the Footlights Review, which, due to the tempest, I had missed in Cambridge, and the other was a one-man comedy performance which was being put on at the Wireworks, a converted factory just behind the Fringe office. I'd been told so many times that this performer, an Oxford graduate called Rowan Atkinson, was not to be missed, that I felt justified in lining up to plank down some cash on tickets for me and the Oedipus cast. There was bad news when I got to the front of the queue. "Ooh, that one's sold out, my darling." "Oh, really? Fried Sue, what else do you... hang on." She picked up the phone, and as she listened to the other end, a smile lit up her face, and she flashed me a happy look. She was a very pretty young Scot, and wonderfully cheerful, given her hard, non-computerised workload. I can still picture her face exactly. "Well, well, that was the Rowan Atkinson people just now to say that due to popular demand, they're doing an extra late-night performance on Saturday night. Can you make it?" I bought 5 tickets and 1 for the Cambridge Footlights and stumbled happily away. We presented our Oedipus every evening for 2 weeks at the Adam House in Chambers Street. The production design was inspired by science fiction films, and the principals and chorus had to wear strange costumes constructed from cut-up sheets of coloured lighting gel, which were a devil to get on in time, given my tight gap between performances. Peter Rumney had chosen W.B. Yeats's translation of the Sophocles original, and I spoke the language well in a mellifluously rhetorical kind of way, but was unable to ascend the heights of tragedy and despair that the play demanded. In fact, I didn't even reach the foothills. Oedipus Rex's journey from commanding greatness to whimpering ruin called in Edinburgh terms for a royal mile that swooped from the elegant squares of the new town into the sinister slums of the old. I gave them a flat Cambridge street with some pleasant window shopping, but about as much pity and terror as a banana milkshake. Nor did our production do well in the turbulent competition for fringe audiences. The Scotsman reviewer described me as the figurehead of the ship, which sounded good until she went on to explain that she meant I was imposing and wooden. Oh, well, none of this worried me. I was having the time of my life. In the Mummers' afternoon show, Artaud at Rodez, amongst other characters, I played the great French actor Jean-Louis Barrault. It was directed by the dynamic and intense Pip Broughton, who had cast Jonathan Taffler, son of the film actor Sidney, in the lead role of Artaud. He was superb and dominated the stage and the production, despite having to spend most of it in a straitjacket. On my fifth evening, as soon as Oedipus came down, I decellophaned myself and hurried away to join an impatient full-house queue that was shuffling its way into the theatre where the Cambridge Footlights were giving their review, Nightcap. "Apparently it's crap this year," I heard from someone behind me as I sat down. "Yeah, night crap," tittered his companion. It was not crap. It was astonishingly good, and the sceptical pair behind me were the first to their feet, whistling and stamping approval when the curtain call came. There were two first years in the show, my friend Emma Thompson, and a tall young man with big blue eyes, triangular red flush marks on his cheeks, and an apologetic presence that was at once appallingly funny and quite inexplicably magnetic. His name, according to a programme that included helpful photographs of the cast, was Hugh Laurie. Another tall man, with lighter but equally blue eyes, curly hair, and a charmingly 1940s manner, was the current president of the Footlights, Robert Bathurst. Martin Bergman, the previous year's president, was in the show too, performing a clever kind of moon-faced epicene MC role. Also in the cast was an astoundingly nimble, twinkly and clownishly gifted comic actor called Simon McBurney, whom I knew because he was, as it happened, Emma's boyfriend. This was, to my shocked mind, as perfect a comedy show as I had ever seen. It had never occurred to me that the Footlights would be this good, so good indeed that I instantly abandoned any dream I might have had of next year dipping my own toe in the waters of sketch comedy. I knew that I could not for a second hold my own with these people. Cool as I wasn't, I had nonetheless absorbed the predominant cool person's view that the Footlights Club was peopled with self-obsessed, semi-professional, show-busy show-offs. What was so extraordinary about Nightcap was how technically perfect in delivery, writing, timing, style and confidence it was, while managing to project a wholly likeable awareness of the absurdity of the whole business of student comedy. It was grown up and polished, yet at the same time bashful and friendly. It was sophisticated and intelligent, but never pretentious or pleased with itself. It had authority, finish, and quality, without any hint of self-regard, vanity, or slickness. It was, in short, just what I believed comedy of this kind ought to be. For all that I had by now been in at least 15 plays, some of which had been comic in some form or other, I did not believe that I would ever have the confidence to knock on the door of a Footlights Club that boasted such assured talents. Hey-ho! At least I might be able to sneer at this Rowan Atkinson fellow. After all, what had Oxford ever done for comedy? Well, Terry Jones and Michael Palin, obviously, but apart from them, what had Oxford ever done for comedy? Dudley Moore? Well, yes, apart from Palin, Jones and Moore, what had Alan Bennett? Yeah, all right, granted, but apart from Michael Palin, Terry Jones, Dudley Moore and Alan Bett, Evelyn Waugh, Oscar Wilde? Oh, all right then, damn you, maybe Oxford weren't such duds after all. Still, I went to the Wireworks not expecting that a one-man show could compete with the skill and style of Nightcap. I staggered out 2 hours later, almost unable to walk. My sides and lungs had taken a hell of a beating. They had never been put to such paroxysmal use in their lives. You've probably seen Rowan Atkinson. If you're lucky, you might have seen him on stage. If you're very, very lucky, then you might have had the experience of seeing him on stage before you'd ever seen him anywhere else. That is the kind of joy that can never be reconstructed, to encounter an astounding talent for the first time with no preconceptions and no especial expectations. I had never watched Rowan Atkinson on television, and I really knew nothing about him other than that his show was a hot ticket. It was called a one-man show, but actually there were two other performers. Richard Curtis, the writer of most of the material, who took the role of a kind of straight man, and Howard Goodall, who played music from an electric piano and sang a witty song of his own. I had noticed from the programme that the staging was the work of Christopher Richardson, whom I had known when I was a schoolboy, and he a master at Uppingham School. I had a brief word with him afterwards, and he told me that the show had previewed at Uppingham. "The theatre has become quite a regular stop on the way between university and Edinburgh," he said. "You must bring some of your Cambridge people." "Oh, I don't... I'm not... we wouldn't..." The drama I was doing at Cambridge suddenly seemed ordinary, worthy and desperately unexciting. I dismissed such unnecessarily negative thoughts from my mind. What was there to complain of? Cherubs Coming Out, Continent. The accelerando that had begun in the second term continued on my return. More drama, less academic study. I now had the option of living out of college in Diggs or staying in and sharing with a fellow second year. Kim and I chose to share, and we were rewarded with a stunning set of rooms in Walnut Tree Court. The ceiling had dark Elizabethan beams, and the walls were panelled in wood. Some of the panels were cut to reveal recessed cupboards, and in one place an area of medieval painted plaster. There were bookshelves, a good gyp room, window seats, leaded panes of warped glass of great antiquity, and far from contemptible furniture. With our books, records, glassware and china, my bust of Shakespeare, Kim's bust of Wagner, Jacques chess set and Bang & Olufsen record player, we were as well set up as any students in the university. The three terms of that second year have blended and blurred in my mind. I do know that it was then that I was asked to join the Cherubs. Hurrah! The initiation ceremony required the draining down of heroically repulsive and impossibly combined flagons of spirit, wine and beer. One also had to recite the meaning of the cherub's emerald, navy and salmon necktie. Green for Queen's College, blue for the Empyrean, and pink for the cherub's body. Another duty was to declare what one would do to advance the cause of cherubs and cherubism. I cannot remember what I said, something arrogant about wearing the tie on television at every opportunity when I was a famous actor, I think. Another initiate, Michael Fole, announced that he would be the first cherub to join all the other cherubs in heaven. When pushed for an explanation, he said that he intended to be the first cherub in space. It was a preposterous claim to make. Space travellers were either American astronauts or Soviet cosmonauts. At some later, slightly less incoherently drunken cherub's party, I discovered that he had been perfectly serious. He had dual UK-US nationality, his mother being American. He was already fluent in Russian, which he had taught himself, reasoning that the future of space exploration would depend on full cooperation and collaboration between the United States and the Soviet Union. He was into his third year of a doctorate in astrophysics and a member of the RAF's Air Training Corps, able to fly just about anything that had wings or rotors. I had never encountered such focus and determination in anyone. 7 years later, he was accepted by NASA as an astronaut. He flew his first space shuttle mission 5 years after that and retired, having spent over a year of his life away from Earth. Until 2008, he held the American record for time spent in space, 374 days, 11 hours and 19 minutes, which is still, needless to say, a British record. I would like to say that his resolve, dedication and commitment were a life-changing example to me. Instead, I thought he was potty and blushed to think how I humoured him. Mike Fole invited me to attend the launch of his mission to repair the Hubble Space Telescope in 1999, but I couldn't go. He invited me again to his final launch in 2003, for which he was appointed commander of the International Space Station. Again, I had to plead other commitments. What was I thinking of? Surely I could have postponed whatever it was I was doing and travelled to the launch site to watch a remarkable man doing one of the most remarkable things any human can do. I regret missing the chance deeply. I hope today's cherubs at Queen's have incorporated a toast into their rituals which recognises the most illustrious and intrepid of their heavenly host ever to don the green, blue and pink. I soon made sure that Kim was initiated into the cherubs too, and perhaps as a kind of thank you, or more likely because he was such a generous soul anyway, Kim offered to have a dinner jacket made for me at a grand tailoring shop on the corner of Silver and Trumpington Streets. Ede and Ravenscroft, besides being fine fashioners of a gentleman's dress suiting, were also makers of elaborate and distinguished academic, legal, ecclesiastical and ceremonial costume, of all kinds from graduate gowns to royal robes. The double-breasted dinner jacket of heavy wool they made for me was a thing of rare beauty. The facings of the lapels were of black silk, as were the stripes down the side of the trouser legs. Kim felt I should have a proper shirt with separate collar to go with it, as well as a good silk black bow tie, and how could any of this be worn without proper shoes? Kim was generous with his money, but he never used it to show off. Not once did he make me feel that I was a lucky recipient of his largesse, or put me in the position of being embarrassed or overwhelmed by it. The kindness was as much in the manner of his generosity as in the quantity of it, although the latter did keep our rooms in enviable luxury. Kim's mother often sent large hampers from Harrods, cases of wine and quantities of cashmere socks for her beloved only child. His father worked in the advertising business, something to do with the sites on which posters were put up, and it was clearly a concern that flourished. My own family's relatively modest prosperity did not, like Kim's, run to truffles, pâté and vintage port, but my mother was able to exhibit more often than was comfortable for a sceptic like me a most uncanny ability to know exactly when and by how much my funds were depleted. A bill from Heffers, the Cambridge bookshop, might arrive in my pigeonhole and loom over me and deprive me of sleep that night, and the following morning there would be a letter from Mother, with a cheque and little note, saying that she hoped that this might come in useful. The sum seemed nearly always to cover the bill and leave a happy amount over for wine and cakes. My sister Jo came to stay. She adored Kim and made friends with everyone, most of whom thought she was an undergraduate, although she was only 15. It was in a letter to her when she was back home that I wrote something that my father saw, something that made it clear that I was gay. He got a message through to the porter's lodge at Queen's asking me to ring. When I called, he told me that he'd seen my letter to Joe, that he was sorry to have done so, but that as far as the gay thing was concerned, he couldn't be happier.
Oh, and your mother would love to speak to you. Darling.
Oh, Mama, are you upset?
Don't be silly. I think I've always known.
It was the most marvellous relief to come out in this way. My scholarly duty of saying Latin grace in hall for a week came round. I began to write occasional articles and television reviews for a student newspaper called Broadsheet, and more parts in more and more plays came my way. I played a disc jockey in Polyakov's City Sugar, a poet in Bond's The Narrow Road to the Deep North, and a classics don in a new play by undergraduate Harry Eyre. I played kings and dukes and old councillors in Shakespeare, and killers and husbands and businessmen and blackmailers in plays old, new, neglected and revived. If Kipling's suggestion that to fill every minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run is truly, as he asserted, the mark of a man, then I seemed to have become one of the most virile students in Cambridge. In the Christmas vacation that fell between the Michaelmas and Lent terms, I accompanied the European Theatre Group on a tour of the continent, bestowing the blessing of Macbeth upon a bewildered population of Dutch, German, Swiss and French theatre-goers, mostly reluctant schoolchildren. The production was directed by Pip Broughton, who had been responsible for Artaud at Rodez, and she had cast Jonathan Taffler as the murderous Thane. Illness prevented him at the last minute, however, which was a great blow to Pip, for she and Jonathan were an enchantingly devoted couple. I played King Duncan, a marvellous role for such a tour, because he dies very soon in the play, and I could spend my time scoping out whichever town we were quartered in, and be back in time for the curtain call, pregnant with information on the best bars and cheapest restaurants. The ETG had been founded by Derek Jacobi, Trevor Nunn and others in 1957, the year of my birth, and had earned a lamentable reputation for its frequent lapses from high seriousness and decorum. There was a rumour that the town of Grenoble had gone so far as to ban all Cambridge drama troupes from ever appearing in their town again after a notoriously drunken exhibition at a mayoral reception sometime in the mid-70s. Well, drunken exhibitionism, if the story is to be believed. Our company was not as bad as that, but we did misbehave on stage. There is something about the sight of row upon row of serious Swiss schoolchildren with copies of Shakespeare on their laps, studiously following the text line by line, that brings out the devil in a British actor. A word of the day would be announced before curtain up, and prizes awarded to whichever actor could most often jemmy that word into their role. "There's no weasel to find the mind's construction in the weasel," I remember saying one night in Heidelberg. "He was a weasel in whom I placed an absolute weasel," and so on. A fellow called Mark Knox, who played many parts, including the messenger who comes to tell Lady Macduff that the evil Macbeth is on his way and means her harm, discovered that his speech of warning could be sung to the tune of Greensleeves, which he did, a finger to his ear, to the great perplexity of a Bernese audience. The Three Witches' When Shall We Three Meet Again was discovered to fit, with only minimal syllabic wrenching, the tune of Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Somehow, throughout all this, Barry Taylor, who had played the squeaking and gibbering Caliban in Ian Softley's Bats May Week Tempest, and had now been called in at the last minute to replace Jonathan Taffler, contrived to produce a superb Macbeth. If I was back early enough from my reconnoitring of the town, I would stand in the wings and watch in admiration as, rising above, or sometimes even joining in the practical jokes, he managed to convey murderous savagery, self-destructive guilt, boiling fury, and terrible pain as well as I had seen. It is, of course, a truism of amateur acting that the cast always believes they are doing something that would stand comparison with the best professional theatre. It is rarely justified. But sometimes there are amateur performances which a pro would be proud of, and Barry Taylor's Macbeth was one such, in my memory at least. We spent far more time travelling between European cities in a Wallace Arnold coach than we did on stage. Devising games and time-passing occupations became a major obsession. Most of us were reading for the English Tripos, and one game we played required us to write down on a slip of paper the major works of literature we had never read. I collected the slips and called out the roster of titles, which included Hamlet, Animal Farm, David Copperfield, Pride and Prejudice, The Great Gatsby, Waiting for Godot, you name an obligatory must-read masterpiece, and there was someone on the bus who had never read it. The wriggles of shame at the depths of our ignorance were as much pleasurable as mortifying. It is something of a relief to know that one is not alone in having a peculiar and inexplicable gap. You will want to know which title I submitted. It was D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love, which, to my no doubt crippling disadvantage and discredit, I still have not read to this day. Nor have I read Sons and Lovers or The Rainbow. You can add all of Thomas Hardy's novels to that list except The Mayor of Casterbridge, which I loathed. I passionately embrace Lawrence and Hardy as poets, but I find their novels unreadable. There! I feel as if I have emerged from a confessional. I hope you do not feel too let down. Challenge 1. My first television performance came around this time. It had nothing to do with acting, but sprang from that same annoying anxiety to show off and be admired that one day, perhaps in my dotage, I will succeed in shaking off. The word had gone around the college that Queen's was entering a team for Granada Television's student quiz show, University Challenge. I'd watched this religiously since I was a child, and could hardly have been more desperate to be picked for the team. The captain had been chosen by some process that I never understood, but he fully justified the appointment. He was a brilliant student of modern and medieval languages called Stephen Botterill, now a renowned Dante scholar and professor at Berkeley, California. He had sensibly decided to pick the three other members of his team by compiling a list of questions and holding an open qualification test. I was infinitely more nervous and excited about sitting this little exam than the official tripos. I cannot remember the questions especially well. One was something to do with Natty Bumper, which I was believed to be able to answer. When a handwritten note from Botterill arrived in my pigeonhole to tell me that I had been picked for the team, I was almost as jubilant and irradiated with joy as the day in 1977 that my mother had telephoned Just John's Delicatique in Norwich to break the news of my scholarship to Queen's. The other two undergraduates chosen were a scientist called Barber and a lawyer called Mark Lester. No, not the child star of Oliver, but another Mark Lester altogether. We travelled north to Granadaland for the first round. It was my first visit to Manchester and my first close-up encounter with a television studio. In Norwich, I'd once sat in the audience for the taping of a largely forgotten Anglia TV sitcom called Backs to the Land, but that was the extent of my penetration of the broadcasting world. Granada was a much more impressive outfit than dear, sweet, parochial Anglia. Their studios were the home of Coronation Street and World in Action. The corridors were lined with photographs of actors, film stars, and nationally known television presenters like Brian Truman and Michael Parkinson. We were shown down a labyrinth of these passageways to a large dressing room where we were asked to wait. We nibbled at crisps and fruit, sipped fizzy drinks, and grew steadily more and more nervous. If we won our first round match, we would have to play another team that same afternoon. If we won that, we would have to return to Manchester at a later date for quarter and semi-finals matches. If we won those, well, a third and final visit would be required. That was a lot of ifs. And suddenly I felt, and perhaps the other three did too, that I knew absolutely nothing. Every single fact I ever knew flew from me like pigeons from the sound of a gun. Humiliation awaited us. I banged the side of my head in a last-minute attempt to rewire the brain. The quizmaster was, of course, the marvellous Bamber Gascoigne, whose voice and features I knew as well as my parents. He was one of those figures like the Queen and Robert Robinson. I could not remember a time when I wasn't aware of him. A wise and kindly man, he seemed aware that other teams knew that he was a Cambridge graduate himself and therefore went out of his way to be scrupulously fair without ever toppling over into self-conscious counter-Canterbridgianism. He always appeared to delight in a correct answer, whencesoever it came, and it was firmly believed by all that he set and researched every question himself. He was famous for his gently knowledgeable corrections. Bad luck, you were thinking of Duns Scotus, perhaps. Or, very close, he was, of course, a friend of Clausewitz. An attitude at some remove from the blessed Jeremy Paxman's scandalised shouts of, "What?" and expression of having bitten into a bad olive whenever an incorrect answer comes his way that offends his sense of what should be known. Autre temps, autre mœurs. Botterill, Lester, Barber and I walked shyly onto the set, made the usual jokes about how the desks were actually side by side on the studio floor, not one on top of the other as they appeared to be on screen, and took our designated seats. I'm afraid to say I cannot recall where the first round opposition came from. Leeds University pops into my head, but I may be mistaken. No doubt they thought we were ghastly Oxbridge wankers. Looking at photographs of our team and its wild trichological variety, geeky earnestness and unhealthy complexions, we cannot be said to have been the prettiest quartet ever to greet a television audience. We need not have been nervous. We were a good side and trounced all the opposition that was ranged against us right up to the final, which in those days was decided by a best-of-three encounter. For that match, we found ourselves pitted against Merton Oxford, my housemaster's old college. They seemed a decent and bright enough bunch, but we brushed them aside in the first leg with a winning margin of over 100. In the second leg, they won by 10 points, which was maddening, but set up one of the tensest finals on record. When the gong sounded for the end of the third and deciding leg, the teams were exactly level. A sudden-death tiebreak came into operation. Whoever got the next question would win the series. Merton buzzed in with the right answer. We were runners-up. I have rarely been so devastated or felt so cheated. It hurts even now that our team can have answered so many more questions correctly than the opposition and yet have lost. Infantile and pathetic, but even as I say these words, 30 years later, The blood surges in my ears, and my whole being seethes with feelings of disgusted outrage, bitter resentment, and maddened disappointment at such shattering injustice. Nothing will ever put it right. Nothing, I tell you, nothing. Oh, well. Corpus Christening. Back at Cambridge as the Lent term came to a close, I was approached by one Mark McCrum, now a well-known travel writer, but in those days a larky, impish undergraduate with a flop of black hair and eyes like glistening currants. His father, Michael, was headmaster of Eton, though shortly to return to Cambridge to take up the mastership of Corpus Christi, and his older brother, Robert, was beginning to make a name for himself in publishing at Faber and Faber. Mark McCrum, with the initiative, enterprise and guileless chutzpah that were trademark characteristics, had taken charge of a small, L-shaped space in St. Edward's Passage belonging to Corpus Christi College. He and his friend Caroline Alton planned to turn it into The Playroom, a drama venue that would specialise in new writing. I knew Caroline Alton and adored her. She had been one of the Macbeth cast, and I had always tried to sit next to her on the coach. She stirred surprising things in me. She and Mark had a most unexpected request. They wanted me to write a play to christen the playroom. Not necessarily full length, perhaps it could be part of a double bill. They had asked a very clever young undergraduate called Robert Farrer to provide the other half of the evening. What did I think? I was flattered, excited and alarmed, keen to try, yet scared of failing. Why did they think I might be capable of writing a play? I'd never written anything close to such a thing in my life. Private poetry and the occasional article for broadsheet were my whole writing career. Go home for the vac. Sit and concentrate. Write about what you know. It'll be brilliant. But bear in mind, it's a really intimate space. Anything you can write that makes the audience feel part of things will be perfect. Term ended, and I returned to Norfolk. Write about what you know is the maxim that I had most heard from writers dead and alive. In my William Morris wallpapered room at the top of the house, I sat at my desk and wondered what I knew. Institutions. I knew schools and I knew prison. That was about it. Involve the audience. I started to write the opening of a lesson in which a prep school master harangues his Latin class, tossing back their exercise books with hyperbolic disdain. "Boys who rub me up the wrong way, Elwin Jones, come to a sticky end." That sort of thing. The audience are the class. There comes a sudden lighting change that alters the time scheme and the dramatic mode, bringing down the fourth wall with a crash. A knock at the door, an older master enters, a story unfolds. I wrote and wrote away, first in longhand on a pad, then typing up each scene on my treasured Hermes 3000 typewriter, a jade-green-keyed and battleship-grey-bodied machine of incomparable solidity and beauty. I contrived a farcical plot incorporating pederasty, blackmail and romance, which was interwoven with other classroom scenes involving the audience in such a way, I hoped, as to satisfy the requirements of Mark's and Caroline's commission. I typed out the title page. Latin, or Tobacco and Boys, a new play by Sue Denim. Pseudonym being pseudonym, of course. I cannot quite recall why I decided to present the play under a nom de plume. I think perhaps I had some hope that if the audience believed it to have been written by a woman, they might forgive the piece its less than radical milieu. Caroline and Mark seemed pleased with it, and a friend from Queens, Simon Cherry, agreed to direct. A law undergraduate called John Davis played the older master, Herbert Brookshaw, and I played Dominic Clark, the young hero of the play, if hero is quite the word we want. The production sold out the playroom for its short run of 3 days, and so, as there seemed to be a demand for more, we performed Latin again for a week in the Trinity Hall Lecture Theatre. I was a playwright. The peculiarly exultant joy that comes over you when you have written a piece of work is like no other. Admiration and acclaim for acting performances, rousing ovations and deafening applause, do not come close to the special pride you feel in having made something that was not there before out of no more exotic a material than words. As a writer, I was approached by Emma Thompson and asked if I might contribute some comedy sketches for a show she was putting on at the ADC Theatre with a group of friends. It was to showcase all-female comic talent and would be called Woman's Hour. I swallowed an inclination to suggest that if it bore that title and had only women performing in it, then surely it should also be written exclusively by women. But it was enough of a step that women were at least putting on their own comedy show. 50 years earlier, they were forbidden to act in plays in Cambridge. Indeed, they were only admitted as full members of the university as recently as 10 years before I was born. Alongside Emma in Woman's Hour was the Footlights' first ever female president, Jan Ravens, and a young Danish-born performer called Sandy Toksvig. I wrote a few of the sketches, the only two I can remember being a parody of a book review programme and a monologue for Emma, in which she played a tweedy, horsey woman at a pony club gymkhana, bellowing encouragement at her daughter. Groundbreaking, revolutionary material. The show was considered a great success, and certainly the talent of Emma, Jan and Sandy was plain for all to see. A friend of Mark McCrum's called Ben Blackshaw now came to me with a play he had written called Have You Seen the Yellow Book? It documented in vivid little scenes the rise and fall of Oscar Wilde. Ben wanted me for the part of Oscar. Ben directed, and we went on in the playroom. Through this play, I received my first review in a national newspaper. The Gay News critic wrote that I carried the lilt of Irish without the brogue. I kept the tiny scrap of paper that formed the entirety of his review in my wallet for years afterwards. Chariots won. The word went round Cambridge that a film company was looking for extras amongst the student body. They had been in touch with the presidents of the ADC, the Mummers and the Marlowe Society, who in turn had contacted the acting world. Kim and I hurried to sign our names up for international stardom. I had a friend at Oxford who had written to me proudly to say the great Michael Cimino was directing a major picture there called Heaven's Gate and that he had a walk-on part in it. I now called him to let him know that we had filming in our midst too. "Oh, yes," he said. "Which studio? We're United Artists." "Oh, I don't think ours is exactly an American studio-type film," I had to confess. "Apparently it's about a group of British athletes in the 1924 Olympics. One of them is Jewish and the other one's a devout Presbyterian who won't run on Sundays or something. Colin Welland has written the screenplay. It's... well, anyway." As I put the phone down, I could hear my friend's snorts of derisive Oxonian laughter. There was something rather humiliating about Cambridge being chosen for such a small, parochial film, while Oxford got a big-budget, major motion picture. Neither of us were to know that Heaven's Gate would all but destroy United Artists and be forever listed as one of the greatest financial disasters in Hollywood history, while our little film... it was called... Chariots of Fire, and I spent a number of bemusedly excited days as an extra. The first was in the Senate House for a Freshers' Fair scene in which the lead actors get recruited by the University Athletics Club and Gilbert and Sullivan Society. All light-headed from a free but fierce haircut, I had earned myself an extra £2, even before the filming began, by bringing my own striped college blazer and flannels as costume. I looked the most dreadful ass as I manned a tennis club stall, bouncing a ball on a racket and trying to give the impression that I might be hearty. With the more important role of captain of the Cambridge University athletics team, one of Cambridge's sporting heroes was just along from me, Derek Pringle, who went on to play cricket for Essex and England. I was most astonished when a props man, just before the camera rolled, came up and gave me a collection of small visiting cards on which were printed Cambridge University Tennis Club, below an image of crossed tennis rackets. I had to peer closely to decipher the sloping New Palace print. The likelihood of the camera capturing this seemed absurdly remote. It struck me as the most astounding waste of time and money. But of course, I knew nothing about filming, or the necessity of being prepared for any eventuality. No matter how detailed the pre-production planning and preparation, circumstances like weather, light, noise, the failure of a crane, or the indisposition of an actor or crew member can alter everything. It was quite possible that the director may have decided that the scene that day needed to open with a close shot of someone taking a tennis club card, and if it hadn't been there ready, waiting and perfectly printed, filming would have been delayed and much more money would have been lost than the price of producing a few visiting cards. None of that occurred to me, of course. I just leapt to the conclusion, as people always do, that filmmakers were imbecile profligates. I now know, being one, that they are imbecile misers. For the whole of the first day, I assumed that the crew member, positioning us all, telling us where and when to move, and yelling for silence and calling for the camera to turn over, must be the director, whose name I knew to be Hugh Hudson. At one point, needing clarification, I started a question with, "Excuse me, Mr. Hudson," and he laughed and pointed to a languid man sitting in a chair reading a newspaper. "I'm just the first assistant," he said. "That's the director." If a director didn't shout and tell people when to move and how to hold their props and where to look, then what, I wondered, did he do? It all seemed most mysterious. The rumour went round Cambridge after only 3 or 4 days shooting, as we pros now called it, that certain university authorities had read the script, disapproved of its implications, and summarily withdrawn from the production company all permissions to film. It seems that the story portrayed the Masters of Trinity and Gonville and Caius colleges, played by John Gielgud and Lindsay Anderson, as anti-Semitic snobs. Their present-day descendants had decided that this was not to be countenanced. Oh well, we thought, that was that, fun while it lasted. But the film's producer, David Putnam, either out of loyalty or for more practical reasons of financial economy, did not fire us. He quickly acquired Eton College as an alternative location, and we were all bussed out to Berkshire, using the nearby Bray Studios as a base. At Eton, they shot one of the most memorable scenes in the film, The Great Court Run, in which Harold Abrahams and Lord Lindsay, played by Ben Cross and Nigel Havers, run a complete circuit of the outer perimeter of Trinity Great Court in the 43 seconds or so, depending on the clock's last winding, that it takes for the chimes to strike 12, a feat that Sebastian Coe just failed to emulate in 1988. School Yard at Eton is probably a quarter the size of Trinity Great Court, but camera angles managed to disguise the fact that even I could probably have run round it in 43 seconds. My role in this scene, along with just about everyone else's, was to cheer and throw my boater wildly in the air. Filming the scene seemed to take an extraordinarily long time. I could not believe how long. It occurred to me that everyone must be extremely incompetent, and that it could surely all have been done so much more quickly and efficiently. I now know that the days were all managed with exemplary order and speed. To an outsider, filming always appears both intolerably boring and horribly disorganised. When you do not understand how something works, it is perhaps natural to question and to doubt. In later years, when, as so often might happen, a passer-by on a street shoot I was involved with expostulated at all those people and how most of them are just hanging around doing nothing, and then offered the suggestion that I suppose it's all under the control of the unions, I would, to tamp down my indignation at such rudeness, force myself to remember my own scepticism when an extra on Chariots of Fire. That scepticism was shared by many, and so bored did the majority become, and so ill-used did they feel themselves to be, that they staged a mini-strike. They all sat down in schoolyard and chanted for more pay. It staggers me how greedy and rude we could have been, and I am pleased to say that Kim and I were not among the Bolshy faction. Putnam appeared before us, and sportingly, without the least sign of annoyance or disappointment, agreed to pay us all an extra £2 each. We cheered him louder than we had been asked to cheer the race. If you happen one day to be watching Chariots of Fire and want to spot me for reasons into which I will not inquire, then the Gilbert and Sullivan entertainment that takes place after the matriculation dinner is the scene to find. I'm lurking and smirking in the background. It is one of nature's cruelest curses on me. No matter how soulful, sweet, and unself-conscious I try to appear, my features always arrange themselves into an expression of utmost self-satisfaction, self-awareness, and self-love. So unfair. Back in Cambridge, life continued its jolly round. Simon Cherry, who had directed Latin, was chosen by Batts to direct the 1980 Maywick production. He cast me as the warty old king in All's Well That Ends Well. Emma Thompson played Helena, Kim had a variety of parts, and Barry Taylor played Parolles. Barry, whose Macbeth had so impressed, was an extraordinary man, and one who made me, without meaning to, feel very guilty and ashamed. He was as genuinely intelligent, perceptive, wise, learned, skilled at writing, and academically gifted as anyone I had ever met. But as far as Cambridge and life in the world outside was concerned, he had one huge defect, one appalling flaw. He was honest. He had integrity. Honesty and integrity are fine virtues, insofar as they go, but they are fatal when it comes to sitting exams. He was in a year above me, so this was his last term at Cambridge, and finals beckoned. If anyone should have got a first and stayed on to research and become a valued teacher and academic, it should have been Barry. But his fatal flaw meant that when he sat in the examination hall and turned over the paper, he would try to answer the question. He would sit and think about it. He would ponder avenues of approach. He would start, cross out what he had written, have another think, and only commit to paper his most considered judgments, appraisals, and conclusions. By the time the whistle blew for the end of the 3 hours, during which time 3 questions should have been addressed and 3 essays completed, Barry would hand in 1 perfect essay and half of a very good one, leaving the 3rd question entirely unanswered. He had done this in Part 1s the year before, and he himself knew that he would probably do it in the finals of the English Tripos that were rapidly approaching. He wrote with delicacy and style, and his literary insights and moral, social, and aesthetic perceptions were of far more value and depth than mine, but he simply could not master the art of timekeeping or manage the compromise of giving examiners what they wanted. He came from a working-class family who lived southeast of London. He told me that on the rare occasions that public schoolboys had got on the bus in Southend or the Isle of Dogs and asked for a ticket in their posh accents, he and his friends at the back would do cawing, honking, drawling impersonations of them, not threateningly or violently, but because the sounds were so peculiar to their ears. It was hard for them to believe that anyone, especially anyone their age, really spoke like that. Then Barry arrived in Cambridge and found that he was the one with the unusual accent, and suddenly rah-rah public school speech was the norm. It took him some time to believe that anyone with such an accent could be anything other than a dim, chinless wonder. How Barry must have regarded a man like me, slick and deceitful enough to answer exam questions in just the way that achieved the best results with the least effort, yet gifted with enough of a memory and knowledge to disguise it as authentic academic achievement, I don't know. Add to that my public school manner and apparent confidence, and I cannot but think that I made up just the kind of package that anyone with spirit would be most likely to despise. Cambridge might have argued, should they have been moved to do so, that their examination system is perfectly suited to the real world. Success in politics, journalism, the civil service, advertising, the foreign office, the city, and so many of the grander fields of professional endeavour rely on the ability quickly to master the essentials of a brief, to subdue material to one's will, to present, promote, and pimp, to massage facts and figures, and to do all with speed, polish, ease, and confidence. The Tripos weeds out the slow, the honest, the careful, the considered, and the excessively truthful, all of whom would be grossly unsuited to public life or high-profile careers. My cynicism and self-criticism may seem distorted and overstated, but I do not think I exaggerate so very much. Certainly the distinction between Barry Taylor's diligent integrity and my own indolent technique remains symbolic of something that is wrong in education and testing. Having said which, Cambridge was not so foolish as entirely to fail to recognise Barry's qualities, and he did subsequently have a career in academia despite not getting the first-class degree that a better system of examination would undoubtedly have awarded him. On the other hand, if continuous assessment existed in my day, and had there been a greater emphasis on written work and research, and less on scrambling to produce essays against the clock in the examination hall, I would have been booted out within months. Perhaps two streams of testing are required, one for plausible bounders like me, and another for authentic minds like Barry. Caledonia 2. A second Edinburgh Fringe season approached. This time, I was exclusively bound up with the Cambridge Mummers, the drama club for whom I had appeared in Artaud at Rodez the previous year. Despite their reputation for progressive programming and emphasis on the modern, radical and avant-garde, they asked if I might consider allowing Latin to join their repertoire. Caroline Alton had written a play about the Swiss kinetic sculptor Jean Tinguely. A friend called Oscar Moore had written a piece whose title I forget, but which had darkly funny things to say about Dunstable. Simon McBurney and Simon Cherry were preparing a one-man show in which McBurney would play Charles Bukowski. A children's play was also being devised, and the main evening show would be a production of the rarely performed Middleton and Decker comedy The Roaring Girl, with Annabel Arden in the title role, under the direction of Bridget Lama. It was Annabel and Bridget who had co-directed the production of Travesties, in which I'd first seen Emma Thompson. All these shows would be presented for 2 weeks in that same cramped but historic Riddles Court venue off the Royal Mile. After the May term finished and I'd completed my usual summer stint at Cundall Manor, we rehearsed for 2 weeks in Cambridge. I stayed in Diggs, Queen's was earning money from renting itself out for a business conference, near Magdalen, with Ben Blackshaw and Mark McCrum, who had, with what grown-ups call commendable enterprise, started a business called Picnic Punts. Every morning they would get up, dress themselves in striped blazers, white flannel trousers and boaters, and go down to a mooring just opposite Queen's, where they kept a single punt. A wooden plank with a white cloth would be placed athwart the vessel as a table, a wind-up gramophone, ice bucket and all the accoutrements required to serve a cream tea with strawberries and champagne would be stowed somewhere, and Mark would erect a handwritten sign on the Silver Street Bridge with illustrations, he was handy at drawing and calligraphy, advertising a punt ride up or down the Cam in the company of genuine undergraduates. Ben was pretty and fey and blonde, and Mark impish and darkly handsome. The dreamy sight of them in their Edwardian whites was guaranteed to appeal to American tourists, day-tripping matrons, and visiting schoolmasters of a Uranian disposition. Sometimes, as I hurried across a bridge between rehearsals, I might hear a Gershwin tune echoing off the stonework of the Bridge of Sighs, or the slowing down and rapid rewinding of a Benny Goodman foxtrot drifting across the meadow opposite King's, and I would smile as I saw Ben and Mark poling their way along the backs, cheerfully making up outrageous and incredible stories about Byron or Darwin for the edification of their credulous and awestruck customers. At day's end, I would come back from my rehearsals, and they would return from the river, muscles aching, tired from talking nonsense, their day's takings wrapped in the tablecloth, which would be emptied on the kitchen table. Every last currency note and coin was scooped up and taken to the grocer's in Jesus Lane to be spent on meat and pasta for that evening, and bottles of wine and tea things and champagne for the following day's punting. I don't think Mark and Ben turned a penny's profit, but they got themselves fit, ate and drank well, and inadvertently started a trend in authentic student punts that is going to this day in the hands of much savvier and harder-nosed entrepreneurs. Not once did either of them suggest that I contribute to the nightly supper fund, despite the fact that I always ate and drank the food and wine that it bought. There was a carefree charm to the pair that made me feel heavy, bourgeois and over-earnest. I'd agreed to be